This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Section 4 of A Second Home by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Clara Bell. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Perry. If the old adage is true that says a woman may be judged of from her front door, her rooms must express her mind with even greater fidelity. Madame de Granville had perhaps stamped the various things she had ordered with the seal of her own character. The young lawyer was certainly startled by the cold, arid solemnity that reigned in these rooms. He found nothing to charm his taste. Everything was discordant. Nothing gratified the eye. The rigid mannerism that prevailed in the sitting-room at Bayeux had invaded his home. The broad panels were hollowed in circles and decorated with those arabesques of which the long, monotonous mouldings are in such bad taste. Anxious to find excuses for his wife, the young husband began again, looking first at the long and lofty anteroom through which the apartment was entered. The colour of the panels, as ordered by his wife, was too heavy, and the very dark green velvet used to cover the benches added to the gloom of this entrance. Not, to be sure, an important room, but giving a first impression, just as we measure a man's intelligence by his first address. An anteroom is a kind of preface which announces what is to follow, but promises nothing. The young husband wondered whether his wife could really have chosen the lamp of an antique pattern which hung in the centre of this bare hall, the pavement of black and white marble, and the paper in imitation of blocks of stone with green moss on them in places. A handsome but not new barometer hung on the middle of one of the walls, as if to accentuate the void. At the sight of it all, he looked round at his wife. He saw her so much pleased by the red braid binding to the cotton curtains, so satisfied with the barometer and the strictly decent statue that ornamented a large Gothic stove, that he had not the barbarous courage to overthrow such deep convictions. Instead of blaming his wife, Granville blamed himself, accusing himself of having failed in his duty of guiding the first steps in Paris of a girl brought up at Bayeux. From this specimen, what might not be expected of the other rooms? What was to be looked for from a woman who took fright at the bare legs of a caryatid, and who would not look at a chandelier or a candlestick if she saw on it the nude outlines of an Egyptian bust? At this date, the school of David was at the height of its glory. All the art of France bore the stamp of his correct design and his love of antique types, which indeed gave his pictures the character of coloured sculpture. But none of these devices of imperial luxury found civic rights under Madame de Granville's roof. The spacious, square drawing-room remained as it had been left from the time of Louis the XV, in white and tarnished gold, lavishly adorned by the architect with checkered lattice-work and the hideous garlands due to the uninventive designers of the time. Still, if harmony had at least prevailed, if the furniture of modern mahogany had but assumed the twisted forms of which Boucher's corrupt taste first set the fashion, Angélique's room would only have suggested the fantastic contrast of a young couple in the 19th century living as though they were in the 18th. But a number of details were in ridiculous discord. The consoles, the clocks, the candelabra were decorated with the military trophies which the wars of the empire commended to the affections of the Parisians, and the Greek helmets, the Roman crossed daggers, and the shields so dear to military enthusiasm that they were introduced on furniture of the most peaceful uses, had no fitness side by side with the delicate and profuse arabesques that delighted Madame de Pompadour. Bigotry tends to an indescribably tiresome kind of humility which does not exclude pride. Whether from modesty or by choice, Madame de Granville seemed to have a horror of light and cheerful colours. Perhaps, too, she imagined that brown and purple beseemed the dignity of a magistrate. How could a girl, accustomed to an austere life, have admitted the luxurious divans that may suggest evil thoughts, the elegant and tempting boudoirs where naughtiness may be imagined? The poor husband was in despair. From the tone in which he approved, only seconding the praises she bestowed on herself, Angélique understood that nothing really pleased him, and she expressed so much regret at her want of success that Granville, who was very much in love, regarded her disappointment as a proof of her affection, instead of resentment for an offence to her self-conceit. After all, could he expect a girl just snatched from the humdrum of country notions, with no experience of the niceties and grace of Paris life, to know or do any better? Rather would he believe that his wife's choice had been overruled by the tradesmen than allow himself to own the truth. If he had been less in love, he would have understood that the dealers, always quick to discern their customers' ideas, had blessed heaven for sending them a tasteless little bigot who would take their old-fashioned goods off their hands. So he comforted the pretty provincial. "Happiness, dear Angélique, does not depend on a more or less elegant piece of furniture. It depends on the wife's sweetness, gentleness, and love." "Why, it is my duty to love you," said Angélique mildly, "and I can have no more delightful duty to carry out." Nature has implanted in the heart of woman so great a desire to please, so deep a craving for love, that even in a youthful bigot, the ideas of salvation and a future existence must give way to the happiness of early married life. And, in fact, from the month of April, when they were married, till the beginning of winter, the husband and wife lived in perfect union. Love and hard work have the grace of making a man tolerably indifferent to external matters. Being obliged to spend half the day in court, fighting for the gravest interests of men's lives or fortunes, Granville was less alive than another might have been to certain facts in his household. If, on a Friday, he found none but Lenten fare, and by chance asked for a dish of meat without getting it, his wife, forbidden by the gospel to tell a lie, could still, by such subterfuges as are permissible in the interests of religion, cloak what was premeditated purpose under some pretext of her own carelessness or the scarcity in the market. She would often exculpate herself at the expense of the cook, and even go so far as to scold him. At that time, young lawyers did not, as they do now, keep the fasts of the church, the four rogation seasons, and the vigils of festivals. So Granville was not at first aware of the regular recurrence of these Lenten meals, which his wife took care should be made dainty by the addition of teal, moorhen, and fish pies, that their amphibious meat or high seasoning might cheat his palate. Thus the young man unconsciously lived in strict orthodoxy, and worked out his salvation without knowing it. On weekdays he did not know whether his wife went to Mass or no. On Sundays, with very natural amiability, he accompanied her to church to make up to her, as it were, for sometimes giving up vespers in favor of his company. He could not at first fully enter into the strictness of his wife's religious views. The theatres, being impossible in summer by reason of the heat, Granville had not even the opportunity of the great success of a piece to give rise to the serious question of play-going. And, in short, at the early stage of union to which a man has been led by a young girl's beauty, he can hardly be exacting as to his amusements. Youth is greedy rather than dainty, and possession has a charm in itself. How should he be keen to note coldness, dignity, and reserve in the woman to whom he ascribes the excitement he himself feels, and lends the glow of the fire that burns within him? He must have attained a certain conjugal calm before he discovers that a bigot sits waiting for love with her arms folded. Granville, therefore, believed himself happy till a fatal event brought its influence to bear on his married life. In the month of November 1808, the canon of Bayeux Cathedral, who had been the keeper of Madame Bontemps's conscience and her daughter's, came to Paris, spurred by the ambition to be at the head of a church in the capital, a position which he regarded perhaps as the stepping-stone to a bishopric. On resuming his former control of this wandering lamb, he was horrified to find her already so much deteriorated by the air of Paris, and strove to reclaim her to his chilly fold. Frightened by the exhortations of this priest, a man of about 8 and 30, who brought with him into the circle of the enlightened and tolerant Paris clergy the bitter provincial Catholicism and the inflexible bigotry which fetter timid souls with endless exactions, Madame de Granville did penance and returned from her Jansenist errors. It would be tiresome to describe minutely all the circumstances which insensibly brought disaster on this household. It will be enough to relate the simple facts without giving them in strict order of time. The first misunderstanding between the young people was, however, a serious one. When Granville took his wife into society, she never declined solemn functions, such as dinners, concerts, or parties, given by the judges superior to her husband in the legal profession. But for a long time she constantly excused herself on the plea of a sick headache when they were invited to a ball. One day Granville, out of patience with these assumed indispositions, destroyed a note of invitation to a ball at the house of a councillor of state, and gave his wife only a verbal invitation. Then, on the evening, her health being quite above suspicion, he took her to a magnificent entertainment. "My dear," said he, on their return home, seeing her wear an offensive air of depression, "your position as a wife, the rank you hold in society, and the fortune you enjoy, impose on you certain duties of which no divine law can relieve you. Are you not your husband's pride? You are required to go to balls when I go, and to appear in a becoming manner." "And what is there, my dear, so disastrous in my dress?" "It is your manner, my dear. When a young man comes up to speak to you, you look so serious that a spiteful person might believe you doubtful of your own virtue. You seem to fear lest a smile should undo you. You really look as though you were asking forgiveness of God for the sins that may be committed around you. The world, my dearest, is not a convent. But, as you mentioned your dress, I may confess to you that it is no less a duty to conform to the customs and fashions of society." "Do you wish that I should display my shape like those indecent women who wear gowns so low that impudent eyes can stare at their bare shoulders and their—" "There is a difference, my dear," said her husband, interrupting her, "between uncovering your whole bust and giving some grace to your dress. You wear three rows of net frills that cover your throat up to your chin. You look as if you had desired your dressmaker to destroy the graceful line of your shoulders and bosom with as much care as a coquette would devote to obtaining from hers a bodice that might emphasize her covered form. Your bust is wrapped in so many folds that everyone was laughing at your affectation of prudery. You would be really grieved if I were to repeat the ill-natured remarks made on your appearance." "Those who admire such obscenity will not have to bear the burthen if we sin," said the lady tartly. "And you did not dance?" asked Granville. "I shall never dance," she replied. "If I tell you that you ought to dance," said her husband sharply. "Yes, you ought to follow the fashions, to wear flowers in your hair and diamonds. Remember, my dear, that rich people, and we are rich, are obliged to keep up luxury in the state. Is it not far better to encourage manufacturers than to distribute money in the form of alms through the medium of the clergy?" "You talk as a statesman," said Angélique. "And you as a priest," he retorted. The discussion was bitter. Madame de Granville's answers, though spoken very sweetly and in a voice as clear as a church bell, showed an obstinacy that betrayed priestly influence. When she appealed to the rights secured to her by Granville's promise, she added that her director specially forbade her going to balls. Then her husband pointed out to her that the priest was overstepping the regulations of the church. This odious theological dispute was renewed with great violence and acerbity on both sides when Granville proposed to take his wife to the play. Finally, the lawyer, whose sole aim was to defeat the pernicious influence exerted over his wife by her old confessor, placed the question on such a footing that Madame de Granville, in a spirit of defiance, referred it by writing to the court of Rome, asking in so many words whether a woman could wear low gowns and go to the play and to balls without compromising her salvation. The reply of the venerable Pope Pius VII came at once, strongly condemning the wife's recalcitrancy and blaming the priest. This letter, a chapter on conjugal duties, might have been dictated by the spirit of Fénelon, whose grace and tenderness pervaded every line. A wife is right to go wherever her husband may take her. Even if she sins by his command, she will not be ultimately held answerable. These two sentences of the Pope's homily only made Madame de Granville and her director accuse him of irreligion. But before this letter had arrived, Granville had discovered the strict observance of fast days that his wife forced upon him, and gave his servants orders to serve him with meat every day in the year. However much annoyed his wife might be by these commands, Granville, who cared not a straw for such indulgence or abstinence, persisted with manly determination. Is it not an offence to the weakest creature that can think at all to be compelled to do, by the will of another, anything that he would otherwise have done simply of his own accord? Of all forms of tyranny, the most odious is that which constantly robs the soul of the merit of its thoughts and deeds. It has to abdicate without having reigned. The word we are readiest to speak, the feelings we most love to express, die when we are commanded to utter them. Ere long, the young man ceased to invite his friends, to give parties or dinners. The house might have been shrouded in crape. A house where the mistress is a bigot has an atmosphere of its own. The servants, who are, of course, under her immediate control, are chosen among a class who call themselves pious, and who have an unmistakable physiognomy. Just as the jolliest fellow alive, when he joins the gendarmerie, has the countenance of a gendarme, so those who give themselves over to the practices of devotion acquire a uniform expression, the habit of lowering their eyes and preserving a sanctimonious mien, clothes them in a livery of hypocrisy which rogues can affect to perfection. And besides, bigots constitute a sort of republic. They all know each other. The servants they recommend and hand on from one to another are a race apart, and preserved by them, as horse breeders will admit no animal into their stables that has not a pedigree. The more the impious, as they are thought, come to understand a household of bigots, the more they perceive that everything is stamped with an indescribable squalor. They find there, at the same time, an appearance of avarice and mystery, as in a miser's home, and the dank scent of cold incense which gives a chill to the stale atmosphere of a chapel. This methodical meanness, this narrowness of thought, which is visible in every detail, can only be expressed by one word, bigotry. In these sinister and pitiless houses, bigotry is written on the furniture, the prints, the pictures. Speech is bigoted, the silence is bigoted, the faces are those of bigots. The transformation of men and things into bigotry is an inexplicable mystery, but the fact is evident. Everybody can see that bigots do not walk, do not sit, do not speak, as men of the world walk, sit, and speak. Under their roof, everyone is ill at ease. No one laughs. Stiffness and formality infect everything, from the mistress's cap down to her pincushion. Eyes are not honest. The folks are more like shadows, and the lady of the house seems perched on a throne of ice. One morning poor Granville discerned with grief and pain that all the symptoms of bigotry had invaded his home. There are in the world different spheres in which the same effects are seen, though produced by dissimilar causes. Dullness hedges such miserable homes round with walls of brass, enclosing the horrors of the desert and the infinite void. The home is not so much a tomb as that far worse thing, a convent. In the center of this icy sphere, the lawyer could study his wife dispassionately. He observed, not without keen regret, the narrow-mindedness that stood confessed in the very way that her hair grew, low on the forehead, which was slightly depressed. He discovered in the perfect regularity of her features a certain set rigidity, which before long made him hate the assumed sweetness that had bewitched him. Intuition told him that one day of disaster those thin lips might say, "My dear, it is for your good." Madame de Granville's complexion was acquiring a dull pallor and an austere expression that were a killjoy to all who came near her. Was this change wrought by the ascetic habits of a Pharisaism which is not piety any more than avarice is economy? It would be hard to say. Beauty without expression is perhaps an imposture. This imperturbable set smile that the young wife always wore when she looked at Granville seemed to be a sort of Jesuitical formula of happiness by which she thought to satisfy all the requirements of married life. Her charity was an offence. Her soulless beauty was monstrous to those who knew her. The mildness of her speech was an irritation. She acted not on feeling, but on duty. There are faults which may yield, in a wife, to the stern lessons of experience, or to a husband's warnings, but nothing can counteract false ideas of religion. An eternity of happiness to be won, set in the scale against worldly enjoyment, triumphs over everything, and makes every pang endurable. Is it not the apotheosis of egotism, of self beyond the grave? Thus even the Pope was censured at the tribunal of the priest and the young devotee. To be always in the right is a feeling which absorbs every other in these tyrannous souls. For some time past a secret struggle had been going on between the ideas of the husband and wife, and the young man was soon weary of a battle to which there could be no end. What man, what temper, can endure the sight of a hypocritically affectionate face and categorical resistance to his slightest wishes? What is to be done with a wife who takes advantage of his passion to protect her coldness, who seems determined on being blandly inexorable, prepares herself ecstatically to play the martyr, and looks on her husband as a scourge from God, a means of flagellation that may spare her the fires of purgatory? What picture can give an idea of these women who make virtue hateful by defying the gentle precepts of that faith which St. John epitomized in the words, "Love one another"? If there was a bonnet to be found in the milliner's shop that was condemned to remain in the window, or to be packed off to the colonies, Granville was certain to see it on his wife's head. If a material of bad color or hideous design were to be found, she would select it. These hapless bigots are heartbreaking in their notions of dress. Want of taste is a defect inseparable from false pietism. And so, in the home life that needs the fullest sympathy, Granville had no true companionship. He went out alone to parties and the theatres. Nothing in his house appealed to him. A huge crucifix that hung between his bed and Angélique's seemed figurative of his destiny. Does it not represent a murdered divinity, a man-god, done to death in all the prime of life and beauty? The ivory of that cross was less cold than Angélique crucifying her husband under the plea of virtue. This it was that lay at the root of their woes. The young wife saw nothing but duty, where she should have given love. Here, one Ash Wednesday, rose the pale and spectral form of fasting in Lent, of total abstinence, commanded in a severe tone, and Granville did not deem it advisable to write in his turn to the Pope and take the opinion of the consistory on the proper way of observing Lent, the Ember Days, and the eve of great festivals. His misfortune was too great. He could not even complain, for what could he say? He had a pretty young wife attached to her duties, virtuous, nay, a model of all the virtues. She had a child every year, nursed them herself, and brought them up in the highest principles. Being charitable, Angélique was promoted to rank as an angel. The old women who constituted the circle in which she moved, for at that time it was not yet the thing for young women to be religious as a matter of fashion, all admired Madame de Granville's piety, and regarded her, not indeed as a virgin, but as a martyr. They blamed not the wife's scruples, but the barbarous philoprogenitiveness of the husband. Granville, by insensible degrees, overdone with work, bereft of conjugal consolations, and weary of a world in which she wandered alone, by the time he was 32, had sunk into the slough of despond. He hated life. Having too lofty a notion of the responsibilities imposed on him by his position to set the example of a dissipated life, he tried to deaden feeling by hard study, and began a great book on law. But he was not allowed to enjoy the monastic peace he had hoped for. When the celestial Angélique saw him desert worldly society to work at home with such regularity, she tried to convert him. It had been a real sorrow to her to know that her husband's opinions were not strictly Christian, and she sometimes wept as she reflected that if her husband should die it would be in a state of final impenitence, so that she could not hope to snatch him from the eternal fires of hell. Thus Granville was a mark for the mean ideas, the vacuous arguments, the narrow views by which his wife, fancying she had achieved the first victory, tried to gain a second by bringing him back within the pale of the church. This was the last straw. What can be more intolerable than the blind struggle in which the obstinacy of a bigot tries to meet the acumen of a lawyer? What more terrible to endure than the acrimonious pinpricks to which a passionate soul prefers a dagger thrust? Granville neglected his home. Everything there was unendurable. His children, broken by their mother's frigid despotism, dared not go with him to the play. Indeed, Granville could never give them any pleasure without bringing down punishment from their terrible mother. His loving nature was weaned to indifference, to a selfishness worse than death. His boys, indeed, he saved from this hell by sending them to school at an early age and insisting on his right to train them. He rarely interfered between his wife and her daughters, but he was resolved that they should marry as soon as they were old enough. Even if he had wished to take violent measures, he could have found no justification. His wife, backed by a formidable army of dowagers, would have had him condemned by the whole world. Thus Granville had no choice but to live in complete isolation. But, crushed under the tyranny of misery, he could not himself bear to see how altered he was by grief and toil. And he dreaded any connection or intimacy with women of the world, having no hope of finding any consolation. End of section 4. Section 5 of A Second Home by Honoré de Balzac, translated by Clara Bell. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bruce Peary. The improving history of this melancholy household gave rise to no events worthy of record during the 15 years between 1806 and 1825. Madame de Granville was exactly the same after losing her husband's affection as she had been during the time when she called herself happy. She paid for masses, beseeching God and the saints to enlighten her as to what the faults were which displeased her husband, and to show her the way to restore the erring sheep. But the more fervent her prayers, the less was Granville to be seen at home. For about 5 years now, having achieved a high position as a judge, Granville had occupied the entresol of the house, to avoid living with the Comtesse de Granville. Every morning a little scene took place, which, if evil tongues are to be believed, is repeated in many households as the result of incompatibility of temper, of moral or physical malady, or of antagonisms leading to such disaster as is recorded in this history. At about 8 in the morning, a housekeeper, bearing no small resemblance to a nun, rang at the Comte de Granville's door. Admitted to the room next to the judge's study, she always repeated the same message to the footman, and always in the same tone. Madame would be glad to know whether Monsieur le Comte has had a good night, and if she is to have the pleasure of his company at breakfast. Monsieur presents his compliments to Madame la Comtesse, the valet would say, after speaking with his master, and begs her to hold him excused. Important business compels him to be in court this morning. A minute later the woman reappeared, and asked on Madame's behalf whether she would have the pleasure of seeing Monsieur le Comte before he went out. "He is gone," was always the reply, though often his carriage was still waiting. This little dialogue by proxy became a daily ceremonial. Granville's servant, a favourite with his master, and the cause of more than one quarrel over his irreligious and dissipated conduct, would even go into his master's room as a matter of form when the count was not there, and come back with the same formula in reply. The aggrieved wife was always on the watch for her husband's return, and standing on the steps so as to meet him like an embodiment of remorse. The petty aggressiveness which lies at the root of the monastic temper was the foundation of Madame de Granville's. She was now 35, and looked 40. When the count was compelled, by decency, to speak to his wife or to dine at home, she was only too well pleased to inflict her company upon him with her acid-sweet remarks and the intolerable dullness of her narrow-minded circle, and she tried to put him in the wrong before the servants and her charitable friends. When, at this time, the post of president in a provincial court was offered to the Comte de Granville, who was in high favour, he begged to be allowed to remain in Paris. This refusal, of which the keeper of the seals alone knew the reasons, gave rise to extraordinary conjectures on the part of the Countess's intimate friends and of her director. Granville, a rich man with 100,000 francs a year, belonged to one of the first families of Normandy. His appointment to be presiding judge would have been the stepping-stone to a peer's seat. Whence this strange lack of ambition? Why had he given up his great book on law? What was the meaning of the dissipation which for nearly 6 years had made him a stranger to his home, his family, his study, to all he ought to hold dear? The Countess's confessor, who based his hopes of a bishopric quite as much on the families he governed as on the services he rendered to an association of which he was an ardent propagator, was much disappointed by Granville's refusal, and tried to insinuate calumnious explanations. If Monsieur le Comte had such an objection to provincial life, it was perhaps because he dreaded finding himself under the necessity of leading a regular life, compelled to set an example of moral conduct, and to live with the Countess, from whom nothing could have alienated him but some illicit connection. For how could a woman so pure as Madame de Granville ever tolerate the disorderly life into which her husband had drifted? The sanctimonious woman accepted as facts these hints, which unluckily were not merely hypothetical, and Madame de Granville was stricken as by a thunderbolt. Angélique, knowing nothing of the world of love and its follies, was so far from conceiving of any conditions of married life unlike those that had alienated her husband as possible, that she believed him to be incapable of the errors which are crimes in the eyes of any wife. When the Count ceased to demand anything of her, she imagined that the tranquillity he now seemed to enjoy was in the course of nature, and as she had really given to him all the love which her heart was capable of feeling for a man, while the priest's conjectures were the utter destruction of the illusions she had hitherto cherished, she defended her husband. At the same time, she could not eradicate the suspicion that had been so ingeniously sown in her soul. These alarms wrought such havoc in her feeble brain that they made her ill. She was worn by low fever. These incidents took place during Lent 1822. She would not pretermit her austerities, and fell into a decline that put her life in danger. Granville's indifference was added torture. His care and attention were such as a nephew feels himself bound to give to some old uncle. Though the Countess had given up her persistent nagging and remonstrances, and tried to receive her husband with affectionate words, the sharpness of the bigot showed through, and one speech would often undo the work of a week. Towards the end of May, the warm breath of spring and more nourishing diet than her Lenten fare restored Madame de Granville to a little strength. One morning, on coming home from Mass, she sat down on a stone bench in the little garden, where the sun's kisses reminded her of the early days of her married life, and she looked back across the years to see wherein she might have failed in her duty as a wife and mother. She was broken in upon by the Abbé Fontanon in an almost indescribable state of excitement. "Has any misfortune befallen you, father?" she asked with filial solicitude. "Ah, I only wish," cried the Normandy priest, "that all the woes inflicted on you by the hand of God were dealt out to me. But, my admirable friend, there are trials to which you can but bow." Can any worse punishments await me than those with which Providence crushes me by making my husband the instrument of his wrath? You must prepare yourself, daughter, to yet worse mischief than we and your pious friends had ever conceived of. Then I may thank God, said the countess, for vouchsafing to use you as the messenger of his will, and thus, as ever, setting the treasures of mercy by the side of the scourges of his wrath, just as in bygone days he showed a spring to Hagar when he had driven her into the desert. He measures your sufferings by the strength of your resignation and the weight of your sins. Speak, I am ready to hear. As she said it, she cast her eyes up to heaven. Speak, Monsieur Fontenot.
For 7 years, Monsieur Granville has lived in sin with a concubine, by whom he has 2 children, and on this adulterous connection he has spent more than 500,000 francs, which ought to have been the property of his legitimate family.
I must see it to believe it, cried the countess.
Far be it from you, exclaimed the abbe. You must forgive my daughter, and wait in patience and prayer till God enlightens your husband, unless indeed you choose to adopt against him the means offered you by human laws.
The long conversation that ensued between the priest and his penitent resulted in an extraordinary change in the countess. She abruptly dismissed him, called her servants, who were alarmed at her flushed face and crazy energy. She ordered her carriage, countermanded it, changed her mind 20 times in the hour, but at last, at about 3 o'clock, as if she had come to some great determination, she went out, leaving the whole household in amazement at such a sudden transformation.
"Is the Count coming home to dinner?"
she asked of his servant, to whom she would never speak.
"No, madame." "Did you go with him to the courts this morning?"
"Yes, madame."
"And today is Monday?"
"Yes, madame."
"Then do the courts sit on Mondays nowadays?"
"Devil take you," cried the man as his mistress drove off, after saying to the coachman, "Routez-vous." Mademoiselle de Bellefeuille was weeping. Roger, sitting by her side, held one of her hands between his own. He was silent, looking by turns at little Charles, who, not understanding his mother's grief, stood speechless at the sight of her tears. At the cot where Eugenie lay sleeping, and Caroline's face, on which grief had the effect of rain falling across the beams of cheerful sunshine.
"Yes, my darling," said Roger, after a long silence, "that is the great secret. I am married. But some day I hope we may form but one family. My wife has been given over ever since last March. I do not wish her dead. Still, if it should please God to take her to himself, I believe she will be happier in paradise than in a world to whose griefs and pleasures she is equally indifferent."
"How I hate that woman! How could she bear to make you unhappy? And yet it is to that unhappiness that I owe my happiness."
Her tears suddenly ceased.
"Caroline, let us hope," cried Roger. "Do not be frightened by anything that priest may have said to you. Though my wife's confessor is a man to be feared for his power in the congregation, if he should try to blight our happiness, I would find means."
"What could you do?"
"We would go to Italy. I would fly."
A shriek that ran out from the adjoining room made Roger start and Mademoiselle de Bellefeuille quake, but she rushed into the drawing-room and there found
Madame de Granville, in a dead faint. When the Countess recovered her senses, she sighed deeply on finding herself supported by the Count and her rival, whom she instinctively pushed away with a gesture of contempt. Mademoiselle de Bellefeuille rose to withdraw. "You are at home, madame," said Granville, taking Caroline by the arm. "Stay." The judge took up his wife in his arms, carried her to the carriage, and got into it with her.
"Who is it that has brought you to the point of wishing me dead, of resolving to fly?"
asked the Countess, looking at her husband with grief mingled with indignation.
"Was I not young? You thought me pretty. What fault have you to find with me? Have I been false to you? Have I not been a virtuous and well-conducted wife? My heart has cherished no image but yours. My ears have listened to no other voice. What duty have I failed in? What have I ever denied you?"
"Happiness, madame," said the Count severely. "You know, madame, that there are two ways of serving God. Some Christians imagine that by going to church at fixed hours to say a Pater Noster, by attending Mass regularly and avoiding sin, they may win heaven. But they, madame, will go to hell. They have not loved God for himself. They have not worshipped him as he chooses to be worshipped. They have made no sacrifice. Though mild in seeming, they are hard on their neighbors. They see the law, the letter, not the spirit. This is how you have treated me, your earthly husband. You have sacrificed my happiness to your salvation. You were always absorbed in prayer when I came to you in gladness of heart. You wept when you should have cheered my toil. You have never tried to satisfy any demands I have made on you."
"And if they were wicked," cried the Countess hotly, "was I to lose my soul to please you?"
"It is a sacrifice which another, a more loving woman, has dared to make," said Granville coldly.
"Dear God," she cried, bursting into tears, "thou hearest. Has he been worthy of the prayers and penance I have lived in, wearing myself out to atone for his sins and my own? Of what avail is virtue?"
"To win heaven, my dear, a woman cannot be at the same time the wife of a man and the spouse of Christ. That would be bigamy. She must choose between a husband and a nunnery. For the sake of future advantage, you have stripped your soul of all the love, all the devotion, which God commands that you should have for me. You have cherished no feeling but hatred."
"Have I not loved you?" she put in.
"No, madame."
"Then what is love?"
the Countess involuntarily inquired. "Love, my dear," replied Granville, with a sort of ironical surprise, "you are incapable of understanding it. The cold sky of Normandy is not that of Spain. This difference of climate is no doubt the secret of our disaster. To yield to our caprices, to guess them, to find pleasure in pain, to sacrifice the world's opinion, your pride, your religion even, and still regard these offerings as mere grains of incense burnt in honor of the idol, that is love."
"The love of ballet girls," cried the Countess in horror. "Such flames cannot last, and must soon leave nothing but ashes and cinders, regret or despair. A wife ought, in my opinion, to bring you true friendship, equable warmth."
"You speak of warmth as negroes speak of ice," retorted the Count with a sardonic smile. "Consider that the humblest daisy has more charms than the proudest and most gorgeous of the red hawthorns that attract us in spring by their strong scent and brilliant color. At the same time,
he went on, I will do you justice. You have kept so precisely in the straight path of imaginary duty prescribed by law, that only to make you understand wherein you have failed towards me, I should be obliged to enter into details which would offend your dignity, and instruct you in matters which would seem to you to undermine all morality.
And you dare to speak of morality when you have but just left the house where you have dissipated your children's fortune in debaucheries? Cried the countess, maddened by her husband's reticence.
There, madame, I must correct you, said the count, coolly interrupting his wife. Though Mademoiselle de Bellefeuille is rich, it is at nobody's expense. My uncle was master of his fortune, and had several heirs. In his lifetime, and out of pure friendship, regarding her as his niece, he gave her the little estate of Bellefeuille. As for anything else, I owe it to his liberality.
Such conduct is only worthy of a Jacobin, said the sanctimonious Angélique.
Madame, you are forgetting that your own father was one of the Jacobins whom you scorn so uncharitably, said the count severely. Citizen Bonton was signing death warrants at a time when my uncle was doing France good service. Madame de Granville was silenced. But after a short pause, the remembrance of what she had just seen reawakened in her soul the jealousy which nothing can kill in a woman's heart, and she murmured, as if to herself, "How can a woman thus destroy her own soul and that of others?"
"Bless me, madame," replied the count, tired of this dialogue. "You yourself may some day have to answer that question."
The countess was scared. "You perhaps will be held excused by the merciful judge who will weigh our sins," he went on, "in consideration of the conviction with which you have worked out my misery. I do not hate you. I hate those who have perverted your heart and your reason. You have prayed for me, just as Mademoiselle de Bellefeuille has given me her heart and crowned my life with love. You should have been my mistress and the prayerful saint by turns. Do me the justice to confess that I am no reprobate, no debauchee. My life was cleanly. Alas, after 7 years of wretchedness, the craving for happiness led me by an imperceptible descent to love another woman and make a second home. And do not imagine that I am singular. There are in this city thousands of husbands, all led by various causes to live this twofold life."
"Great God!" cried the countess, "how heavy is the cross thou hast laid on me to bear! If the husband thou hast given me here below in thy wrath can only be made happy through my death, take me to thyself."
"If you had always breathed such admirable sentiments and such devotion, we should be happy yet," said the count coldly.
"Indeed," cried Angélique, melting into a flood of tears, "forgive me if I have done any wrong. Yes, monsieur, I am ready to obey you in all things, feeling sure that you will desire nothing but what is just and natural. Henceforth I will be all you can wish your wife to be."
"If your purpose, madame, is to compel me to say that I no longer love you, I shall find the cruel courage to tell you so. Can I command my heart? Can I wipe out in an instant the traces of 15 years of suffering? I have ceased to love. These words contain a mystery as deep as lies the words I love. Esteem, respect, friendship may be won, lost, regained. But as to love, I might school myself for 1,000 years, and it would not blossom again.
especially for a woman too old to respond to it.
I hope, Monsieur le Comte, I sincerely hope, that such words may not be spoken to you some day by the woman you love, and in such a tone and accent.
Will you put on a dress à la grecque this evening, and come to the opera? The shudder with which the Countess received the suggestion was a mute reply.
Early in December 1833, a man whose perfectly white hair and worn features seemed to show that he was aged by grief rather than by years, was walking at midnight along the Rue Gaillon. Having reached a house of modest appearance and only two stories high, he paused to look up at one of the attic windows that pierced the roof at regular intervals. A dim light scarcely showed through the humble panes, some of which had been repaired with paper. The man below was watching the wavering glimmer with the vague curiosity of a Paris idler, when a young man came out of the house. As the light of the street lamp fell full on the face of the first comer, it will not seem surprising that, in spite of the darkness, this young man went towards the passer-by, though with the hesitancy that is usual when we have any fear of making a mistake in recognizing an acquaintance.
"What, is it you?" cried he. "Monsieur le Président! Alone at this hour, and so far from the Rue Saint-Lazare. Allow me to have the honour of giving you my arm. The pavement is so greasy this morning that if we do not hold each other up," he added, to soothe the elder man's susceptibilities, "we shall find it hard to escape a tumble."
"But, my dear sir, I am no more than 55, unfortunately for me," replied the Comte de Granville. "A physician of your celebrity must know that at that age a man is still hale and strong."
"Then you are in waiting on a lady, I suppose," replied Horace Bianchon.
"You are not, I imagine, in the habit of going about Paris on foot, when a man keeps such fine horses." "Still, when I am not visiting in the evening, I commonly return from the courts or the club on foot," replied the Count.
"And with large sums of money about you, perhaps," cried the doctor. "It is a positive invitation to the assassin's knife."
"I am not afraid of that," said Granville, with melancholy indifference.
"But at least do not stand about," said the doctor, leading the Count towards the boulevard. "A little more and I shall believe that you are bent on robbing me of your last illness, and dying by some other hand than mine."
"You caught me playing the spy," said the Count. "Whether on foot or in a carriage, and at whatever hour of the night I may come by, I have for some time past observed at a window on the third floor of your house the shadow of a person who seems to work with heroic constancy." The Count paused as if he felt some sudden pain. "And I take as great an interest in that garret," he went on, "as a citizen of Paris must feel in the finishing of the Palais Royal."
"Well," said Horace Bianchon eagerly, "I can tell you."
"Tell me nothing," replied Granville, cutting the doctor short. "I would not give a centime to know whether the shadow that moves across that shabby blind is that of a man or a woman, nor whether the inhabitant of that attic is happy or miserable, though I was surprised to see no one at work there this evening, and though I stopped to look, it was solely for the pleasure of indulging in conjectures as numerous and as idiotic as those of idlers who see a building left half-finished. For 9 years, my young—" The Count hesitated to use a word, then he waved his hand, exclaiming, "No, I will not say friend.
I hate everything that savors of sentiment. Well, for 9 years past, I have ceased to wonder that old men amuse themselves with growing flowers and planting trees. The events of life have taught them disbelief in all human affection. And I grew old within a few days. I will no longer attach myself to any creature, but to unreasoning animals, or plants, or superficial things. I think more of Taglioni's grace than of all human feeling. I abhor life and the world in which I live alone. Nothing, nothing, he went on in a tone that startled the younger man. No, nothing can move or interest me.
But you have children.
My children, he repeated bitterly. Yes, well, is not my eldest daughter the Comtesse de Vandenesse? The other will, through her sister's connections, make some good match. As to my sons, have they not succeeded? The Viscount was public prosecutor at Limoges, and is now president of the court at Orléans. The younger is public prosecutor in Paris. My children have their own cares, their own anxieties, and business to attend to. If, of all those hearts, one had been devoted to me, if one had tried by entire affection to fill up the void I have here, and he struck his breast, well, that one would have failed in life, have sacrificed it to me. And why should he? Why? To bring sunshine into my few remaining years? And would he have succeeded? Might I not have accepted such generosity as a debt? But, doctor, and the count smiled with deep irony, it is not for nothing that we teach them arithmetic and how to count. At this moment, perhaps, they are waiting for my money.
Oh, Monsieur le Comte, how could such an idea enter your head? You who are kind, friendly, and humane. Indeed, if I were not myself a living proof of the benevolence you exercise so liberally and so nobly.
To please myself, replied the Count, I pay for a sensation, as I would to-morrow pay a pile of gold to recover the most childish illusion that would but make my heart glow. I help my fellow-creatures for my own sake, just as I gamble, and I look for gratitude from none. I should see you die without blinking, and I beg of you to feel the same with regard to me. I tell you, young man, the events of life have swept over my heart like the lavas of Vesuvius over Herculaneum. The town is there, dead.
Those who have brought a soul as warm and as living as yours was to such a pitch of indifference are indeed guilty.
Say no more, said the Count with a shudder of aversion.
You have a malady which you ought to allow me to treat, said Bianchon in a tone of deep emotion.
What, do you know of a cure for death? Cried the Count irritably.
I undertake, Monsieur le Comte, to revive the heart you believe to be frozen.
Are you a match for Talma, then? Asked the Count satirically.
No, Monsieur le Comte, but nature is as far above Talma as Talma is superior to me. Listen. The garret you are interested in is inhabited by a woman of about 30, and in her love is carried to fanaticism. The object of her adoration is a young man of pleasing appearance, but endowed by some malignant fairy with every conceivable vice. This fellow is a gambler, and it is hard to say which he is most addicted to, wine or women. He has, to my knowledge, committed acts deserving punishment by law. Well,
and to him this unhappy woman sacrificed a life of ease, a man who worshipped her and the father of her children. But what is wrong, Monsieur le Comte?
Nothing. Go on.
She has allowed him to squander a perfect fortune. She would, I believe, give him the world if she had it. She works night and day, and many a time she has, without a murmur, seen the wretch she adores rob her even of the money saved to buy the clothes the children need and their food for the morrow. Only 3 days ago she sold her hair, the finest hair I ever saw. He came in, she could not hide the gold piece quickly enough, and he asked her for it. For a smile, for a kiss, she gave up the price of a fortnight's life and peace. Is it not dreadful, and yet sublime? But work is wearing her cheeks hollow. Her children's crying has broken her heart. She is ill, and at this moment on her wretched bed. This evening they had nothing to eat. The children have not strength to cry. They were silent when I went up.
Horace Bianchon stood still.
Just then the Comte de Granville, in spite of himself, as it were, had put his hand into his waistcoat pocket.
I can guess, my young friend, how it is that she is yet alive, if you attend her, said the elder man.
Oh, poor soul, cried the doctor, who could refuse to help her? I only wish I were richer, for I hope to cure her of her passion.
But how can you expect me to pity a form of misery of which the joys, to me, would seem cheaply purchased with my whole fortune? Exclaimed the Count, taking his hand out of his pocket, empty of the notes which Bianchon had supposed his patron to be feeling for. That woman feels. She is alive. Would not Louis XV have given his kingdom to rise from the grave and have 3 days of youth and life? And is not that the history of thousands of dead men, thousands of sick men, thousands of old men?
Poor Caroline, cried Bianchon. As he heard the name, the Count shuddered, and grasped the doctor's arm with the grip of an iron vice, as it seemed to Bianchon.
Her name is Caroline Crochard, asked the President, in a voice that was evidently broken.
"Then you know her?" said the doctor, astonished.
"And the wretch's name is Soulevay. Aye, you have kept your word," exclaimed Granville. "You have roused my heart to the most terrible pain it can suffer till it is dust. That emotion, too, is a gift from hell, and I always know how to pay those debts."
By this time the Count and the doctor had reached the corner of the Rue de la Chaussée d'Antin. One of those night-birds who wander round with a basket on their back and crook in hand, and were, during the Revolution, facetiously called the Committee of Research, was standing by the curbstone where the two men now stopped. This scavenger had a shriveled face worthy of those immortalized by Charlet in his caricatures of the sweepers of Paris.
"Do you ever pick up a 1,000-franc note?"
"Now and then, master."
"And you restore them?"
"It depends on the reward offered."
"You're the man for me," cried the Count, giving the man a 1,000-franc note. "Take this. But remember, I give it to you on condition of your spending it at the wine shop, of your getting drunk, fighting, beating your wife, blacking your friend's eyes. That will give work to the watch, the surgeon, the druggist, perhaps to the police, the public prosecutor, the judge, and the prison warders. Do not try to do anything else, or the devil will be revenged on you sooner or later." A draftsman would need at once the pencil of Charlet and of Callot,
the brush of Teniers and of Rembrandt, to give a true notion of this night scene. Now I have squared accounts with hell, and had some pleasure for my money, said the Count in a deep voice, pointing out the indescribable physiognomy of the gaping scavenger to the doctor, who stood stupefied. As for Caroline Crochard, she may die of hunger and thirst, hearing the heart-rending shrieks of her starving children, and convinced of the baseness of the man she loves. I will not give a sou to rescue her. And because you have helped her, I will see you no more. The Count left Bianchon standing like a statue, and walked as briskly as a young man to the Rue Saint-Lazare, soon reaching the little house where he resided, and where, to his surprise, he found a carriage waiting at the door. "Monsieur, your son, the attorney-general, came about an hour since," said the man-servant, "and is waiting for you in your bedroom." Granville signed to the man to leave him. "What motive can be strong enough to require you to infringe the order I have given my children never to come to me unless I send for them?" asked the Count of his son as he went into the room. "Father," replied the younger man in a tremulous voice and with great respect, "I venture to hope that you will forgive me when you have heard me." "Your reply is proper," said the Count. "Sit down," and he pointed to a chair. "But whether I walk up and down or take a seat, speak without heeding me." "Father," the son went on, "this afternoon at 4 o'clock, a very young man who was arrested in the house of a friend of mine, whom he had robbed to a considerable extent, appealed to you. He says he is your son."
"His name?" asked the Count hoarsely.
"Charles Clochard."
"That will do," said the father with an imperious wave of the hand. Granville paced the room in solemn silence, and his son took care not to break it. "My son," he began, and the words were pronounced in a voice so mild and fatherly that the young lawyer started. "Charles Clochard spoke the truth. I am glad you came to me tonight, my good Eugène," he added. "Here is a considerable sum of money," and he gave him a bundle of banknotes. "You can make any use of them you think proper in this matter. I trust you implicitly, and approve beforehand whatever arrangements you may make, either in the present or for the future. Eugène, my dear son, kiss me. We part, perhaps for the last time. I shall tomorrow crave my dismissal from the king, and I am going to Italy. Though a father owes no account of his life to his children, he is bound to bequeath to them the experience fate sells him so dearly. Is it not a part of their inheritance?" "When you marry," the Count went on with a little involuntary shudder, "do not undertake it lightly. That act is the most important of all which society requires of us. Remember to study at your leisure the character of the woman who is to be your partner. But consult me, too. I will judge of her myself. A lack of union between husband and wife, from whatever cause, leads to terrible misfortune. Sooner or later we are always punished for contravening the social law. But I will write to you on this subject from Florence. A father who has the honor of presiding over a supreme court of justice must not have to blush in the presence of his son. Goodbye." End of section 5. End of A Second Home by Honoré de Balzac. Translated by Clara Bell.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.